Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Robert Epstein, who is a senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology in California. He's the author of 15 books and the former editor-in-chief of Psychology Today. His books include Teen 2.0, Saving Our Children and Families from the Torment of Adolescence, and Passing the Turing Test, Philosophical and Methodological Issues in the Quest for Thinking Computers. He's going to talk to us today about the brain as a computer and how that metaphor is not only incorrect, but unhelpful. Hello, Robert. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure.
Okay, well, the reason I contacted you for this interview is because you've recently written an article for Aeon magazine entitled The Empty Brain, Your Brain Does Not Process Information, Retrieve Knowledge, or Store Memories. In short, your brain is not a computer. Now, I'll provide a link for this for any listeners wanting to read the article. But first of all, what was it that prompted you to write it, Robert?
It's something I've been thinking about for a long, long time. I mean, at least 20 years. I've been programming since I was 13, so that's quite a long time. That's almost 50 years.
Yeah.
And it has just bothered me more and more in recent decades, the fact that so many experts in so many fields have come to speak about the functioning of the brain, in other words, the functioning of human beings, as if we are computers, and have looked at the brain as if it is a computer, or at least an information processing system. And I know without doubt that that is incorrect. It is not even slightly correct. So it finally just it just came to a head. I just felt I really needed to write this down and share my views with others. And I'm completely shocked by the reception. Quite shocked.
In what way? In what way are you shocked?
Well, this issue was somewhat esoteric, but. And therefore that not many people would be interested in what I wrote. But at this moment in time, I understand that we've passed 500,000 views and we've passed 80,000 shares on Facebook. And the day they posted this article, that Aeon Magazine posted it, it crashed their website, which is a first for me and for the magazine.
Wow. Okay, well, let's dive in then, Robert. You argue that flawed metaphors about the brain and human intelligence have a very long history.
Well, yes. Obviously, there's something remarkable about our intelligence. And therefore, practically as long as people could speak, it appears that they have been speculating about our intelligence and where it comes from and why we're so very different from, you know, others in the animal kingdom and from all other animals, obviously. And there have been various metaphors proposed over the years, which grammatically appear to explain our intelligence. I emphasize grammatically, but which in fact don't explain it at all. The earliest one was the notion that that at conception or at birth we are infused with a spirit of some sort, a holy spirit or some other spirit, and so we're intelligent because the spirit is. So there you go. So grammatically, you see, we've explained it because the word because is in the sentence. We're intelligent because the spirit is intelligent that has infused us. And really, you know, that was a very, very powerful idea, still is to many people around the world. And that really has stuck around for thousands of years, that particular idea. But over time, other metaphors were introduced. They tended to have to do with the technology of the time. So, you know, again, several thousand years ago, at some point, there was a great deal done with water, with aqueducts, and with fluids. And we saw the beginnings of a fluid metaphor of intelligence. The fact that our brain is quite wet probably helped that metaphor. And that metaphor also stuck around for a very long time. So, you know, even in much of the world, particularly in Europe, diseases were being treated by methods such as bloodletting, the notion that liquid humors, you know, accounted for disease. Well, that was very powerful. And the idea that these fluids somehow were responsible for our intelligence, that was part of the story. But of course, it's just a story. So the stories continue. They go on and on to mechanical ideas and so on. And then finally, in the 1940s, when computers are invented, in large part with the help of a very brilliant Englishman named Alan Turing,
yeah.
Not long after, I mean, and this should come as no surprise to anybody, but not long after, in the early 50s, mid 50s, the notion that that we're intelligent because the brain works like a computer was introduced, first by a man named Miller, an American psychologist, and then by one of the early computer pioneers, von Neumann. And this idea really has caught on and has really propelled thinking and research in multiple fields. And it has even impacted the way, lay people talk about intelligence and the brain. So we talk about ourselves as, you know, retrieving ideas and storing things and processing information. And that's even just become part of the vernacular. So, yeah, the metaphors have been around for a long time because the brain is it's the most complicated thing we've ever tried to study. And the computer metaphor has really, really taken on a tremendous life. And at this point, and I do not exaggerate, in both Europe and the U.S., that metaphor is behind literally billions of euros, billions of dollars in funding are being spent because of that metaphor. They're tied very closely to that metaphor. And that, I think, is outrageous.
You in the article, you use a metaphor yourself that we have an empty brain. How is that more adequate than the computer metaphor?
Okay, well, the empty brain, that's a title. And I did not come up with that title, but I have to say I do love it. I love the title. And that was an editor, you know, at Aeon Magazine. And that's what editors do. Editors put titles on things. Because I'm a magazine editor myself, so I know how this works, because I work with Scientific American, and before that I was editor-in-chief of Psychology Today. So, you know, editors put titles on things so that to attract readers.
Yeah.
But I disavow the title immediately at the beginning of the article. I point out the brain is far from empty, that in fact we are certainly equipped, our brains are equipped with all kinds of remarkable abilities, you know, even at birth, the most important one being our ability to learn. So, you know, the brain is built in a way that allows it to change in an orderly way as a result of experience. So it changes, and it's built to change, and it changes in an orderly way as a result of experience. So it's not empty.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to do, though, is get us away from the computer metaphor, or any metaphor for that matter, because a metaphor is a story. It's just a story. It doesn't, it's something you use out of desperation, when you don't really understand, you know, how the mechanism works, or how this lump of neurons and so on, how it works. Then we invent stories, and that's all it is. And it's a fundamentally, very silly story, very, very weak story. Because we work nothing like computers work, nothing.
Imagine you were trying to explain what the brain does to, say, a seven-year-old kid. How would you get across roughly what the brain does?
Well, the most you can tell a 7-year-old is something about the anatomy. You can talk about certain unusual kinds of cells that we don't see in the rest of the body, such as the neuron. You can talk about the fact that that neurons are again very unusual in that they are part of an elaborate electrochemical system, that they do in fact build up a kind of a charge and then they discharge. That's called an action potential. I mean, there are lots of things you can say, but all of these things turns out when it comes to intelligence are quite superficial.
Yeah.
But when I say they're superficial, all these wonderful things you could say to a 7-year-old, they're quite superficial because no one on the planet has the slightest idea how these characteristics of the brain have anything to do with our intelligence. So to give you an example from my article, something as simple as the melody of a symphony, let's say Beethoven's Fifth, we have no idea how it is, having listened to Beethoven's Fifth, how it is sometime later we're able to, to hum Beethoven's Fifth. No one has any idea how that occurs. Again, the computer metaphor, of course, says that somehow we store a representation of the melody in our brain. But you see, there is nothing stored in the brain. There's no information stored in the brain, period. And there's and neuroscientists could look for 1,000 years. They will never find in any form anything like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, any representation of it will never be found in the brain. Never. We don't work that way.
So just to sort of summarize that, so this representational view of things, which you find not only in science, but, it has a long history in philosophy too, that you're having a sort of picture in your mind of what is the case beyond your mind, and is deeply flawed.
It is deeply flawed, yes. You see, now, before there were computers, the storage metaphor still existed. It always has existed with respect to some sort of technology of whatever era we're talking about. So at one point there was a kind of library metaphor used, for example, still the notion of storage.
Yeah.
Even though the word information wasn't used necessarily. But yes, this idea that representations of the world somehow, get stored in us is a very powerful idea. There is no evidence that any representations exist. And what I'm saying is, if we begin to realize that we are in fact organisms, we're part of the natural world, that you have to consider other possibilities. The simplest possibility, which I try to explain in the article, the simplest possibility is simply that there is orderly change.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got that notion of orderly change, then you don't need the idea of representation at all. Because when in fact I listen to a symphony and I hum back as best I can, I hum back the melody, the evidence that I know something about this the symphony is that in the future I might be able to hum it back again. That in the future, if someone asks me to hum the melody of Beethoven's Fifth, in fact, I will do it reasonably well. But I can do this without having stored anything, and I can do it without having retrieved anything. All that had to have occurred is that my brain changed in some orderly way, having had the experience, and now as a result, I can now hum a melody reasonably well. I keep emphasizing reasonably well because, whatever the heck is going on in there, it doesn't work that well. It's nothing like a computer in the sense that a computer actually takes a representation of a stimulus and actually stores it, and it doesn't deteriorate or anything. It doesn't change. Just stay, and then it moves it around, and then at some point or other, it can retrieve it and give it back to you exactly as it stored it.
Yeah.
So that's why I keep saying regarding whatever it is we do it reasonably well, or in fact, many, many cases, very poorly. Not only that, if say you tell me a story and ask me to repeat back the story immediately, I will repeat it back differently than you said it.
Chinese whispers.
Yes. If you ask me to repeat it back a week later, I'll repeat it back even more poorly. And if you ask me a year from now, even more poorly, and so on. And so another famous Englishman wrote a book about this called Remembering. This is Sir Frederick Bartlett.
Yeah.
It was published in the 1930s. And this is exactly what he did. He told people a story and asked them to repeat it back after varying delays, sometimes after delays of years. And it's just marvelous. I mean, what happens is exactly what we know would happen, which is that you repeat it back immediately, you know, fairly poorly, and then a week later it's worse, and then a year later it's much worse. And I think he went as far as 10 years, at which point people could come up with, you know, the topic of the story, maybe a couple of details, and that's it. But the thread, the actual plot was completely gone. So whatever it is that we do, we don't do it anything like a computer, and we do it kind of very imperfectly. So all you need is the notion of orderly change.
Yeah.
Now, how many neurons are involved? Which neurons are? It could be 12 neurons that are involved. It could be 12 million. It could be 12 billion. You know, and in fact, there is some evidence from research on the brain that, you know, even very simple, you know, trying to recall very simple things from our past sometimes seems to involve many hundreds of millions of neurons.
Yeah.
So whatever the change is, it might not be simple. It might be very complicated. Now, I also introduce something which I think is quite important and which I've not seen people talk about very much, and it's what I call the uniqueness problem. And to me, this is the heart of my essay, although I've not seen people paying much attention to this, which is a shame, because this really is the heart of it. Once you realize that all we need to talk about is orderly change, and that's all we need, oh, now we have a problem. Because, you see, it's very likely that when you listen to Beethoven's Fifth, your brain changes in some way. Then I listen to Beethoven's Fifth, it's quite likely that my brain changes in a completely different way. Because, you see, what's happening is, you know, you're bringing to bear on that situation your brain, which has its own history. And so when you listen, you're listening to different things than I would listen to, perhaps. And you have different knowledge of music, so you might think of it in a different way as you're listening. You have a whole different perspective on the music. Maybe you know something about, you know, the theory of chords, you know, that I don't know anything about. And so on. So the fact is, what happens in your brain when you listen is almost certainly completely different than what happens in my brain.
Sure. Yeah.
Now we have a very big problem, because this makes us unique, not only genetically, which is interesting, of course, but this makes our brains absolutely unique. And it means there's no possible way that you could scan a brain and extract information from it, as we see in the movies. It means there's no possible way we could download the contents of a brain into a computer and live forever, as my old friend Ray Kurzweil thinks one can do. And there's just no possible way. I mean, we are what we are, and what we are is fascinating and marvelous and wonderful.
No, I very much agree with that, Robert. And it makes me think of something like poetry, and I think poetry is a great way to cultivate a tolerance of ambiguity, because, as you say, when we ever listen to something, read something like that, we bring our own experience into the mix. It's a sort of interaction between the, and that you could say that for all art, really, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Well, everything that happens to us moment to moment in time, we're bringing to bear our experience.
Yeah.
And so we are paying attention to, we are attending to different elements of what's occurring, and we are changing in a way that has to do with what we're paying attention to, and we're changing in a way that has to do with our background, our knowledge, and so on. So now that we've changed as a result of this new experience, having listened to Beethoven's Fifth being performed by a great symphony, the fact is, whatever state we're now in also keeps changing.
Yeah,
that's great. It never stops. It never stops. So that whatever it is we got from that one experience that we just had a few minutes ago, it doesn't even matter, because it's constantly subject to further change. The process never stops. And of course, when the system starts to deteriorate, which is inevitable, it happens with all of us, then we're not losing memories, you see. We're just losing the ability to re-experience our past. And I think that's when we use the memory metaphor, I think really that's what we're talking about, generally speaking. We're saying that we can rehear something, even though it's absent.
Yeah.
We can rehear it to some extent. Now that we can rehear it, we can now reproduce it to some extent. Well, as the brain deteriorates, we're able less and less to be able to re-experience our past. And therefore, we lose more and more of our past. And of course, over time, we even lose more and more of our own identity. And I think that this process, in a way, to me, it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying I'm looking forward to deteriorating. I'm just saying that the process is extraordinary right from the outset, and it's incredibly complex. And to me, it's utterly beautiful. And I think we should try to understand it for what it is.
Yeah, no, I agree. We're not robots, aren't we? Anyway, just two more questions, Robert. In many ways, not any of this stuff is new. Arguably, the digital computer analogy started falling apart in the 80s with sort of parallel distributed processing and neural network architectures. I'm thinking of Francisco Varela here. And then came embodied cognition in the 90s. And then also John Searle's Chinese Room thought experiment in philosophy. And you also talk in the article about the more recent work of the cognitive scientist Anthony Chimero that completely rejects the view that human brains work like a computer. However, despite all the evidence to the contrary, it's still very, very pervasive, not only on the street, but still very much in the sciences. So what is it that makes it so sticky, this metaphor?
I think the reason why this metaphor is so sticky is because of a faulty syllogism. Now, people are turning up who are criticizing me here and saying that no, it's not true. But I really think this syllogism is there in the background, largely unexamined. And the syllogism, as all syllogisms do, has three parts. And the first part is that all computers are capable of behaving intelligently, and I think that's reasonable to say. And I think that that's what makes the computer so remarkable an invention, and that's what makes it different from something like a can opener, in that all computers can be programmed in a way so that they behave somewhat intelligently, in fact, somewhat like humans behave. So there's number one. Number two is that all computers are, in fact, information processors. It doesn't matter what kind of architecture they use. And of course, the vast majority of computers ever built only use one kind of architecture, which is it's all digital, generally speaking, non-parallel, kind of linear in function. And they all use roughly the same. There are a few newer kinds that have slightly different architecture, but that's irrelevant. They're still all information processors. They all still they create representations of numbers and letters and so on, and then they store those, and then they manipulate those, and then they retrieve, and they all do that. So now we've got pieces of the syllogism, and the third one is therefore, and this is the faulty conclusion. Therefore, all entities that are capable of behaving intelligently are information processors. And I honestly believe that's the underlying problem here. That's what makes this notion so sticky. And of course, that syllogism is faulty. If you make some lovely little Venn diagrams, you can show people who aren't familiar, with the rules of logic. You can still show people you know, how utterly flawed that conclusion is. And in fact, the idea, by the way, that humans should be considered information processors just because computers are information processors, that idea, I know, some days people are going to look back on it and think it was just preposterous.
Yeah, it makes me think of the another syllogism. All monkeys climb trees, porcupines are monkeys, therefore porcupines climb trees.
Yeah, I think the stickiness also has to do with the fact that two fields have been advancing very rapidly. And this I did not really write about in any detail at all, but the fact is two fields, it almost coincidentally, have been advancing very rapidly. One is computer science and the other is neuroscience. And I think that that's part of the problem too. The fact that these two fields have grown so fast, more or less, simultaneously, you know, this has simply been created opportunities for a lot of people to employ this metaphor to start all kinds of programs, to get grant support, and in some cases to set up enormous programs involving hundreds of universities. So I think that's part of the problem as well.
Okay. All right. My last question, Robert. The middle way, as we understand it, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things. That then arguably throws us back onto experience. So we're left in this sort of messy, uncertain middle. But it's in this messy, uncertain middle that we can actually perhaps start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, whatever they are. How might this relate to what we've been talking about today?
Oh, it very much relates, because and this is where some people have been a little dissatisfied with my essay. Because I do end up in a messy, uncertain middle, which I think is marvelous. I think that's where we should be. The messy, uncertain middle regarding the brain is to acknowledge that we really have no idea, how it works, at least in regard to our intelligence. And we do know some interesting things, and and there's a lot more we need to learn about. And it's going to take us quite a while. In fact, some leading neuroscientists whom I cite actually are suggesting it might take 100 years or even hundreds of years to begin to understand how the brain makes us intelligent. And so that certainly puts us in a messy, uncertain middle. And I think we should cherish that. I think we should cherish it. I think we should cherish the messy, uncertain middle, cherish the fact that we're organisms, cherish the fact that we don't know everything. Cherish the fact that some things are extremely hard to understand, and then just go from there.
Yeah, well, I'm with you all the way there, Robert, and thank you very much for a fascinating interview, and it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.